Chapter 6. Going down, down, down. Nevertheless, the Cashes moved to California in August 1958, driving the 1,800 miles with 3-year-old Roseanne, 2-year-old Kathy, and the newly born Cynthia, Cindy. Initially, they rented an apartment on Coldwater Canyon Avenue in North Hollywood, where Cindy's bed had to be made up in a drawer. A few months later, they moved into a $75,000 ranch house with a swimming pool on Havenhurst Avenue in Encino, bought from TV host Johnny Carson, who had moved to New York to start a new show for NBC. They became near neighbors to John Wayne and Clark Gable. Shortly afterwards, Marshall and Luther moved to the San Fernando Valley. At the time, most recording stars considered acting the next big career step once they had a few hit singles under their belts. Bob Neal, who'd folded his Stars Incorporated agency in June, had been led to believe that Cash had a good shot at hosting a regular music show on TV. With these and other opportunities in mind, Johnny Cash Enterprises established itself at the crossroads of the world, a prestigious Spanish-style building on Sunset Boulevard. "Johnny and I both felt we could storm Hollywood," Neal later said. Recording for Columbia took place at the Owen Bradley Studios in Nashville, and after cutting enough tracks for his first album with Don Law, boldly titled The Fabulous Johnny Cash, he started work on his first collection of gospel songs, Hymns by Johnny Cash. Half of the songs were published hymns, and half were new songs either written or arranged by Cash. The liner notes stated, "Johnny Cash turns his attention from the popular songs that have made him one of the brightest stars of today to the simpler songs of faith and devotion, presenting a program that combines religious feeling with music in splendid fashion." One of the first new friends Cash made in California was Johnny Westren, a 23-year-old recording artist introduced to him at the office by Gordon Terry. Western, his real name, was a singing cowboy who had performed with the legendary Sons of the Pioneers and had once been Gene Autry's featured singer and guitarist. His recording, The Ballad of Paladin, was currently the theme song of Have Gun, Will Travel, a popular CBS series in which he had also acted. Cash invited him to play on some guitar transcriptions at McGregor Studios in Hollywood for discs that were distributed to the armed forces and after that to open for him on a tour of California. Then came some shows in the Midwest that featured Gordon Terry. From these beginnings grew what would become the Johnny Cash Show. The only changing feature was the female vocalists. For the first year, Rose Maddox had a spot, and the next year, Patsy Cline. "Then we took Barbara Mandrell on her first tour when she was only 13 years old," remembers Western. "That was a tour in 1962, and Patsy took care of her." Even though Cash now headlined a showcase he had put together himself, the rigors of touring differed little from his days as a support act. Now he had a trailer packed with suitcases and instruments to tow behind the car. Western always tuned two identical Martin guitars for him because Cash's escalating drug habit meant that he would often accidentally drop his instruments. Some guests didn't trust Cash's driving ability, and so a second car was brought along. "He was the world's worst driver," says Western. "Patsy Cline wouldn't ride if he was driving. She would only ride with Gordon Terry or me, and she was the best road buddy in the world." Touring was one part ecstasy to three parts monotony. The excitement of being away from home and on the move soon paled, particularly when visiting towns for the second or third time. In order to quell the inevitable boredom, the Cash entourage developed the art of hotel destruction, something that fell somewhere between outright vandalism and an elaborate practical joke. Each member developed a specific role. Marshall Grant's areas of expertise included cutting up furniture and setting off explosions. As Johnny Western explains, he would carry a small Black & Decker circle saw. What he would then do is cut the legs off the furniture in his hotel room and then put them back in place so that everything looked perfectly all right. When the maid walked in, the whole room would fall apart as soon as she touched something with her duster. Marshall usually arranged the explosions in open spaces late at night, purely for amusement. He started with firecrackers and small amounts of gunpowder, but eventually only found satisfaction with sticks of dynamite that he would pack around with yards of string. One of his most exciting discoveries was a single cannon that he would sometimes fire down hotel corridors. He even managed to adapt it for shooting gravel at neon signs on the highway. Gordon Terry specialized in painting and decorating. He would carefully paint everything in the room, not only the furniture but also the walls and ceiling. Sometimes even the mirrors and television would get a quick coat. The result was even more surreal because it was so professionally executed. "We didn't mess up the room," says Marshall Grant. "We did a good job on it. It was a bizarre thing to do, and if you did it today, you'd probably get sent to jail. We always used to pay for the damage. We'd say that we had had a party, and someone had got a bit overexcited. The manager would ask for $50 or $100, and that's what would happen. Looking back, it seems quite ridiculous, and it's not something that I'm too proud of." Cash and Western often did something appropriately cowboyish, like setting up shootouts with replica Colt 45s in hotel lobbies, or arranging for someone in the party to be publicly kidnapped and bundled into a waiting car in front of gawking pedestrians. More out of frustration than as a stunt, Cash once stuck a Bowie knife into a Mona Lisa reproduction in a hotel room that didn't measure up to his standards. One of their most elaborate jokes took place during a stay at the Waldorf Astoria in New York. Cash and Stu Carnall procured bales of hay and buckets of manure from a riding stable in Central Park and smuggled them into their room via a service elevator. They then proceeded to carefully spread the straw across every available inch of floor space before checking out. "It had a beautiful rug in this room," remembers Western, "but by the time they had finished, it looked as though Trigger had been living there for a week." Some of the stunts had a touch of comic genius. In Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, they removed all the furniture from a hotel room and placed it outside the elevator, with two of the troupe tucked up in single beds. They then called for room service. When the waiter came up with the food, he immediately went back down to fetch the manager. By the time the manager arrived on the scene, the hall was completely clear. The routine was then repeated with another call to the waiter. Other stunts were inexcusably destructive and foreshadowed the hotel vandalism by bands like The Who and Led Zeppelin by at least 10 years. Johnny Cash and the Tennessee Two must have been the first traveling band to fill a bathtub with Jell-O, create a connecting doorway with a fire axe, explode cherry bombs in a toilet, smear fish paste on radiators, and toss light fixtures out of windows just to hear the sound they made on impact. As their reputation as pranksters and vandals increased, they found themselves banned from certain hotels, and country artists in general became viewed with suspicion by hoteliers. Although Cash had guest appearances in four TV westerns, Tales of Wells Fargo, Shotgun Slade, Wagon Train, and The Rebel, for which he sang the theme, his only big screen appearance was as a drugged-up killer in the film noir 5 Minutes to Live, later marketed as Door-to-Door Maniac. "Part of the reason he came to California was to be an actor," says Johnny Western. "He knew that he couldn't do that while living in Memphis. But then he was touring so much that he often wasn't around when offers came up. When studios call you, they want you today. They're not going to hang around and wait until you come back to town." Cash was now away from home 80% of the time, traveling 300,000 miles a year. It would be easy to say that his marriage to Vivian fell apart simply because he was absent too often, that he wanted a wife who traveled, and she wanted a husband who stayed at home. The truth is that they were never really suited to each other, having completely different backgrounds, beliefs, life experiences, interests, and expectations. They'd each married some sort of projection of their youthful desires, fueled by 3 years of passionate letter writing. No one would have guessed the Cashes were having marital troubles from the publicity of the time. Cash was always portrayed as the contented family man who liked nothing more than being at home with his charming wife and 3 little daughters. Vivian perpetuated the image of domestic tranquility through her letters in Cash's fan magazine, in which she had talked about him planting rose bushes and hosting barbecues for friends while she looked after the children and played in the local bowling league. Vivian didn't like the music business, and not just because it had taken her husband away from her. She didn't feel comfortable around music business people. Rare photographs of her taken backstage show a painfully shy woman obviously feeling out of place. Because music was so important to Cash, he interpreted Vivian's discomfort as a rejection of who he was. Out on the road, Cash was meeting sassy women who loved music and the music business as much as he did. They were often forthright, wickedly funny, and sexually alluring, quite unlike the simple country girls he had dated in Dias. Most importantly, they made him feel good about himself.